Good afternoon, everybody. Robin Ayoub here again from the Localization Fireside Chat. And welcome to another recording. Welcome to another episode. With this recording, we are recording episode 237 or 38, if memory serves me correctly. And that's number four today. We still have two to go tonight, this afternoon. So I really appreciate you coming along the journey with me as we record this episode, as we continue the authentic conversation or the unfiltered conversations with various leaders around tech, localization, and humanity in general. I had an earlier episode sort of got me thinking about many things. We talked about what happened to your digital assets after you die in the past episode. So this is the easy part. That here, this particular episode, I really engaged with. I love it. And I'm not saying the other one wasn't, but sort of makes your head scratch a little bit. So I want to welcome today's guest. Our guest of honor is Kincaid Day. And Kincaid, I don't know if I got your latest title correctly. Feel free to correct me. VP of Global Strategy and Innovation at WeLocalize. So WeLocalize is, for those of you who are not from the industry, from the outside looking in, is one of the largest companies in the localization industry in our world, which we call the localization industry. And Kincaid joins me from Montana. And did I pronounce
it? Missoula. Missoula, Montana. Yeah. You got it, Robin.
Missoula. Yeah. So, Kincaid, welcome to the conversation. I appreciate having you with me, and let's get into it.
Thank you so much for having me today. Really looking forward to the conversation.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. And as you know, for the audience, I mean, you heard me talk a lot about this on the podcast. Our industry is going through many transformations, right? So, we're not the only industry that's going through that transformation. As contrary to common belief, we tend to think all the transformation is happening in our industry, but it's happened across the board, specifically around the knowledge-based industry. But generally, all industries are being impacted with what the new technologies are bringing on board. So I want to make sure that we frame this correctly, because we're going to get into a specific conversation with Kincaid here in a minute. But before we get into it, if you don't mind, Kincaid, as we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. Let's start with this one. What's your story? How did you get here?
All right, let's dive in. So a little bit about me. You know, I'm born and raised really small town, right outside of Billings, Montana. A farm town, if you will. I graduated with 47 kids, and I guess you could say I was always a technologist growing up. Academic career, I actually went to school for experimental music composition, which is kind of an interesting path to say the least. But it gave me an opportunity to leverage relevant tools at the time to compose things and be creative. I studied abroad. I got really inspired. And, you know, post school, I was looking for a gig. And so I'd moved to Seattle, my very early 20s. And my introduction, funny enough, was via video game testing. You know, prior to that, I did work for a company called Lionbridge for a while, doing some annotation work for, you know, one of those big tech companies out there. And then from there, I got into the testing space where I was on a large campus in Redmond, Washington, doing some things, if you will, getting some exposure to more or less like how content's produced at scale and more or less what that pipeline looks like. There was a job opportunity that came up for business development in the localization space, specifically around selling localization services as well as video game testing services, and went for it. I ended up getting the job. And so I was 23 years old with a quota that's quite large now that I realize for my age and my professional maturity. But yeah, to say the least, I cut my teeth selling localization to some of the largest technology companies in the world in my early 20s. They gave me a lot of interesting insights working with specific products, if you will, organizations around marketing, but just truly just understanding this industry. But funny enough, back then, I was also selling AI services. It was back then called machine learning, around transcription, annotation, which was, you know, it was a proper pairing, if you will, for a localization company at the time, and still is today. Did that for a while, and then I had a small startup at the time reach out to me from San Francisco, where I was hired. It was a company called CloudWords. Just brief little overview about that company. It was a pure play technology company enabling customers to automate their localization at scale, specifically in the marketing space. So for me, I'd been selling services, but I kind of wanted to get more into the technology side of the house. And so that gave me an opportunity as originally technical account manager, and then worked my way up managing product, customer success. And for there, I really got exposure to, I guess you could say, the ROI of localization. It's one thing that, it's funny enough, I ask customers all the time, it's like, hey, how do you measure the value of content that's being created at scale? And it is a tricky conversation. There's so much perspective and data that goes into being able to frame that. But in short, I had the opportunity of working with Fortune 100 companies, processing truly, and I won't say which companies that this is a data point for, but processing billions of dollars worth of content. What I mean by that, I actually was able to have insight shared with me that marketing content specifically that was running through our platform, they were generating over $1.5 billion with that localized content. And then we found through automation that we were able to raise this company's revenue by about 6 to 7%, which is pretty fascinating when you just think about that localization journey. And that's because we were able to remove human tasks, which is kind of a theme what we'll talk about later today when it comes to AI. But what we were able to do is set up integrations. We were able to remove the download, offline edit, the upload, you know, maybe go build an asset in a Marketo or an AEM and build out these end-to-end pipelines, right? So spent a lot of time in that space as a technologist, not on the LSP side, which is really important to note, working with customers to solve, you know, value-related problems for the industry. And then I guess not to tell too long of a story after that, I was at a company called Scientific for a while, where I was hired in to actually work on their internal technology, you know, looking at agentic flows, things of that nature. So that was a bit of a hybrid time in my life where I worked on Loc, but then also AI data services, which is a really relevant topic anymore because we're seeing this intersection, if you will, between both of these industries where they're converging with these specialist tasks to produce performative models. Then I was approached by an investor where me and a couple of friends, I guess you could say, we co-founded a company, done some advisory work along the line, along the journey, I should say, excuse me. And then I took some time off for some personal reasons and then was looking to come back into the Loc space. And around that time, I had seen that WeLocalize had actually purchased CloudWords, that company I mentioned earlier. So I had some contacts, I'd reached out, was really intrigued with some of the technology that they were initially just starting to build at the time. And it was really relevant to my past experience. And so I'd originally joined in on the AI ML operations side. It was really relevant where we're implementing and I guess you could say structuring these agentic systems for localization specifically on behalf of our customer. And then from there, I stepped back into more of the commercial realm where now in my role as, you know, VP of, you know, global strategy and innovation, it's just a fancy way of saying that I get to be the guy that I think I have one of the funnest jobs, meets with all of our customers on a day-to-day basis, all of our product engineering teams, all of our linguists, et cetera. And I get to also work with our analysts to understand what's that signal where customers looking to solve a problem where they need assistance from, say, a partner such as us to go out and build technology or to potentially expand upon their technology to just solve for these future state needs. But I guess that's my elongated elevator pitch of my journey thus far.
You know, it's amazing. I don't know how old you are, but you've had so many stops along the career.
35, Robin. Yeah,
to get here. Wow, yes. This is amazing. You know, I'm looking through your LinkedIn profile. You've got two stops, you know?
I have. And for me, you'll notice during the COVID times, you know, a lot of us, I guess you could say, had a little extra free time on our hands. And so from there, in full disclosure, on a personal note, you know, I lived in Seattle for about 10 years and I went to school for music. So the dream was always, hey, let's go have the day job and go have some fun on the side. Maybe I'll be a DJ one day and do these things. Like, you know, we always have those fun.
Well, I'm not the only one who wants to be a DJ. Okay.
Right. It's a really relevant topic these days. Well, and then COVID happens, right? And it's like, well, shoot, that's not going to happen anytime soon. And so there's actually some new technology that was introduced, or I shouldn't say new technology introduced. I should say technology that was being leveraged around that time. And specifically that was blockchain technology. And for me, it was a really fascinating concept as it relates to tokenization of assets and things. And so I had some early success actually advising some companies. We did quite well going to market. And then I was a part of a startup there that was venture backed for a brief stint. And I'd known the founder and I was like, hey, I do want to just kind of branch out of like Loc for a little bit. I want to go into this new innovative space and kind of tease things up for AI in a way. And it's like, what kind of problems can we solve? And so I had the opportunity, and I can probably state this, but working with companies such as like Liquid Death or Prey.com, these really big brands, and looking at innovative tech back then, what we would call Web3, and how we could build out communities and how we could, you know, just create like this feedback loop of not just a consumer buying a product, but if you were to buy a product, you could be a part of a larger experience. So it was a quite fun time for me. But to the point, I get really excited around innovation. And so, you know, I've been a tinkerer, if you will. I actually was using LLMs in the early 2020s, and I was advising for a really well-known YouTube personality and a business coach, right? And so what I'd actually done is I'd indexed everything this individual had ever said, from YouTube to podcasts, you name it. And I created this company called Jump Search, because this individual has a community and network now, truly, in the past few years, grown to over 1 million people. And what they need is his insights, his inspiration. Like, you know, he's not an accessible personality when they call him up, send him an email. So they wanted this coaching. And so what we did is we consolidated all of his knowledge into a single platform and originally built this company that would allow anybody to type in a word, a phrase, a sentence, and it would tell you exactly what podcast, what YouTube video, what article that was in. And so I just like to bring that up because back then, the cost of me building that company, and it just makes me sick, cost me tens and tens of thousands of dollars, and the GPU consumption in the cloud, all of that was just like almost unbearable. Now with like the introduction of Claude and where we're at, I'm like, dude, I could have built that company for $600, you know, so time is everything, right? But, yeah, no, exactly. And I think about bringing it back up because I ended up shutting it down just because it was costing me so much money. But the point is, it's like, I think a core fundamental principle about me, I'm just a really curious individual. And I obsess about, you know, you can read LinkedIn all day or X or whatever it may be, and you just see what cool people are building. And so for me, it's like, if there's ever an opportunity to build something and solve a problem, make some revenue along the way, why not go for it? So that's why you'll see a few additional logos in my LinkedIn versus, say, the average person.
Well, curiosity is always nice. And, you know, curiosity a lot of times leads into many good things. The indifference, I guess, that's the, you know, the death of our knowledge collection altogether, or trying to find knowledge. If you're indifferent to anything, you don't learn. You don't just
exactly.
Know, I've heard it with so many people in the past on this channel. You have to be curious, and if you're not curious, you checked out. Basically, you're not part of the system anymore. You're outside of the system looking in.
I couldn't agree more, Robin. Like, truly, like, and sorry to interrupt, but to that point, it's like, I want to highlight that because I see so many observers in this space where now with, you know, in the age of LLMs and AI, I feel like everybody can educate themselves on any topic, also be builders when they've never been able to be builders, but allows them to truly participate in this, I don't know, this greater communal event that we're kind of going through as a human race. Not to sound too philosophical, but it's true. Like, I'm seeing 16, 17-year-old kids build $10 million companies in a weekend. It's true. They'll have an idea, they can execute it and take it to market. And so for me, it's like, that's the one thing I hope people are just not too afraid to just jump in and try, because there's so much opportunity right now.
You know, I just did a podcast last month with a young man out of Montreal, 18 years old, quit school, started a company online, got his first VC money. That's why he quit school. Over $10 million. I said, I don't believe you. I said, I want to talk to the guy. I want to connect with him. I'm looking at the guy on my podcast and you know, I love him dearly now because I had a chance to do a podcast with the guy. And I just still can't believe it. I said, who is the person? He gave me the name. I connected with the person on LinkedIn. Yeah. And I went through down the trail, you know, did you do it? Yes, I did. And here's why. And to your point, I've got a friend of mine who asked me one day, he said, my 9 years old is building an AI app. And I was wondering, which one do you recommend? And I said, you what? You're nine years old? For what? What is he building an app for?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's amazing.
a school project. Oh, I said, okay, school project. Then that's
why. Not starting a company, is he?
No, look, the point that you're making is very true. We, at an age, at a phase of our lives as a humanity, where you've got all the tools available to you right now. Knowledge is democratized. It is not concentrated anymore. It's democratized. Everybody has access to it. You can learn. You can adapt. You can build. You can do anything you want, really. I mean, any topic that you're interested in, do a little bit of research, build, make money out of it. Possibilities are completely endless. Now, where it gets really sort of questionable is when people take the easy road, the lazy road, I would call it. You know, I would, you know, we talked a little bit about this on the channel, is when you overlay, for instance, technology on top of bad processes, which this industry is famous for, without analyzing any processes. Oh, the boss says we need to go AI. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's scramble. Let's put AI in. And then I talked to somebody, the CEO or somebody at the executive. Did you deploy AI? Yeah, yeah. We gave them access. We gave all our staff access to AI. Did you teach them how to use it? What are you doing with this?
Like, to the point, I have actually really relevant example, you know, specifically in the localization industry. And we had an ex-customer now, right? And we've seen this transition really since the beginning of the year. To your point, you have these internal top-down initiatives like, hey, everybody go use AI. And it's kind of this interesting feedback loop. You read a news article, you see a headline, and people are claiming that certain problems can be solved just by this plug-and-play methodology. But it's never that simple. You know, and we'll see companies that end up burning millions of dollars in tokens because you had an agentic system and they're just running on their own, so on and so forth. So of course, there's like cost risk. But then what it is I saw a technical organization take over a localization function recently, right? And really great customer, doing great work. They've been a partner for quite some time. And there was a top-down initiative. Hey, we need to look at this as, you know, more of like a utility function, because there is different perspectives of localization and that value that I had, you know, I'd mentioned, right? And what they did is like, hey, we're just going to take this on ourselves. We're going to use agents and LLMs to do all the loc functions. We're going to automate everything. And I'm like, well, what's your linguist network look like? They're like, what's that? You know? And it's like, okay, so you have to kind of like let them, you know, jump out of the nest, if you will, and learn to fly a little bit. Because for me, and I guess I don't want to sound too biased, but I think most of the people in the industry would agree, any company doing that, they're introducing so much risk from the perception of the quality of content, because we're not just talking about product or internal technical documentations. Now imagine if your CEO has a brief or a newsletter that needs to go out into 30 plus languages. And imagine you're using an agentic system. If there's a mistranslation in that context, and say you're a public company, like that could actually influence and alter your stock price, for instance, right? So for me, I was just like kind of taken back, and you can't like argue it. We know that this is happening in the industry. And so you just have to be as complimentary as possible to give them guardrails and frameworks where you're able to. And then for those that are really ambitious, you just, hey, we'll be in touch and we're one phone call away when you do need us, right? But to your point, I'm just seeing it all over the place currently.
You know, I was going to ask you this question anyway. It was on my list here. The word agentic is doing a lot of under-examined work, I would say, in the industry in general, like on the buyer, on the customer side, on the LSP side, everywhere. And I know we localize, your system's called Opal, right?
Opal, that's correct. Yep.
Is an agentic system, my understanding from my research. What's it doing actually that perhaps, is it traditional MT, or is it outside of that, or is it in addition to that? Maybe you can give us a little bit of brief on Opal, and how is that whole post-editing pipeline is being affected with Opal?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so with the introduction of LLMs, and again, these early stage initiatives, and we saw customers, and if you think about it, right, the localization was kind of teed up to be in a bad spot in a way from public perception, because language is in large language model. So out of the box, people just thought that these LLMs and these AI systems were just going to be able to simply solve this problem. But, you know, naturally there was market demand. And so we knew we needed to adapt here at the company. And that's one of the reasons I came on board. They had a really good vision. They're making lots of good progress. And we had a great team of researchers, data scientists, et cetera. And essentially the solution that we initially came up with, and we're expanding upon that, we have a lot of customers using it. So I just want to mention before I get into it, that it is live. This isn't hypothetical, theoretical tech here. Yeah. Like this is actually performative, and we're seeing real results, but it's a combination of three elements. Okay. So Opal, we still leverage neural MT within this ecosystem. That's the cool thing. And maybe this isn't the best example. I'm not an engineer. I'm going to first, you know, off say that here is, but like, I like to look at like neural MT. It's almost like a calculator. It's this one-to-one thing where you can like more or less have it execute very specific tasks. And it's quite good at it still, where LLMs are more of like a computational engine where it can be quite creative. And so what we've done is we've leveraged proven technology to maximize that potential. And then the other components of Opal are AIPE and AIQE. So what we do is we have automated post-editing where we work with our clients, taking all of their historical content, right? And then what we're able to do is, I would say you could synthesize and sanitize the data, and you can have it, you know, specifically aligned with customers' specific goals and objectives as it relates to content types or end goal scenarios. And so AIP then takes that content, it does an initial first pass at editing the content, where maybe in a traditional look process, you'd have two linguists, right? First one, you know, doing the initial edits, the second one would come in, do the finalize, the sign off, so on and so forth. Then what we did is, so after the automated post editing is done via our LLM, we then leverage AIQE, which is our quality estimation model. And so what that is, it's adjustable thresholds, and versus thinking of it as like the AI is telling you if the content's good enough, like, hey, this is good content, you can ship it. What we actually did is we pivoted our thinking into more of a risk categorization. So what we do is we align with the customer to define those risk thresholds on a per content type basis. Because again, to my example earlier with that one company, imagine you have technical documentation, it's to enable your internal workforce. We might not need to spend all of the resource hours into really making that top tier quality content. We might just need something quick and easy to get turned back into the, you know, into those resources so they could leverage it. But the point is, we can actually address these thresholds to maximize human effort. So what QE is actually doing is it's giving all of our linguists a signal of how they should maximize their time. Because between MT and the PE, we're making really good progress with providing really high quality content. The QE is then directing that to the linguists, where we can actually, if it's really high quality, low risk, we can lock that down so they can avoid having to spend any effort. They still have visibility, of course, that's really important, but then they can go in and they can address any critical or high impact segments. The beauty of this ecosystem, though, is we're able to capture all that context of the data being generated from our linguists, which then go back and improve those systems. And to like lift the hood, if you will, the way that that works is we're not just using one specific model, okay? We use a model garden approach. And what that's really valuable to note for, on behalf of our customer, is we'll see a customer that has a contract, say, with one of the large commercial frontier labs, okay? That means they're confined to using that agent in any capacity. That means they couldn't go use one of those competitors. For us, what we're doing is continuous benchmarking for all the languages, the content types, to ensure that when Opal's performing, that it's truly as dialed in as possible. And then say, and shoot, it used to be a 3 to 6 month turnover when it comes to new models being introduced, but it seems like every 2 weeks these days. What our data science and our quality teams are doing is we're constantly benchmarking all of this performative technology, if you will, and then we're always adapting that solution. So in other words, the customer can always ensure that they have the best, most optimal solution in the market without having to take on any of that technical responsibility. And so that's really what allows this to work. In addition, though, to Opal itself, it isn't just like an internal technology. And I think this is really important to note. Our philosophy, if you will, when it came to producing this is like, hey, one, of course, we'll introduce this to our customers, but you maybe saw, I think it was back in January, maybe February, we actually partnered with Phrase. So you can use our technology within, say, a TMS such as Phrase, and we have other integrations as well, because we had a lot of customers that were working with us and they really were, you know, appreciating the output and the performance, but they're like, hey, we want to use it with the rest of our vendor ecosystem. And so for us, we took a different approach than, say, the rest of the industry, you know, and I shouldn't say not everybody's this way, but the point is for LSPs, typically you want to get as much of that volume and that work for, you know, your human services possible, where we just took an inverse perspective and said, hey, no, let's take the technology and allow that customer to use it any which way they see fit so they can truly achieve whatever they'd like to at scale.
And I'm assuming the version that is exposed to the customer is different than the version used internally?
No, that's a good question. Actually, it's the exact same technology. So what we actually do is we have our proprietary approach. And I should note, like our AIQE methodology, we do have a patent on that. And so it is quite specific. And a lot of the data science, and I should say I'll just label it as a professional services element that goes into the setup. We still manage all of that on our side. So for instance, the technology layer is exposed, but we come in as a partner to work with those customers to deploy that technology. And then when it's up and running, just think of it as like these, you know, these language or content pipelines that the customer then can route all their content to. But then it's the linguist network, right? If they would like to use different vendors for different content types or scenarios, we're not restricting that in any which way. And we just saw the value in that because, you know, for us, there's no benefit of us trying to, you know, it goes into the whole walled garden. We'll probably talk about that later, right? There's no benefit for us.
Got a segment on the
model. Yeah, just to tee up, we don't want to trap a customer into having to use this one specific approach. We want to provide them with the best solution at scale. And we know large customers and the majority of the customers we work with, due to those internal procurement initiatives, things of that nature, they do need to diversify due to the nature of, you know, the sizable spend. They don't feel comfortable sometimes just working with one specific vendor. So it was kind of the best of both worlds approach from our perspective.
Another question on Opal, if you don't mind, Kincaid. My understanding is it's got two tiers. You probably have it maybe for the audience who want me to wrap their head around it. One, or if you enable it, it keeps the linguist in the loop, basically. And the other one is called Automate, which means it's straight through processing with no human touch.
Now, you got it.
You named one customer, which is Intuit, I guess. It was part of, I don't know, I was doing research. It was one of your customers. I'm not sure if it's an existing customer or an ex-customer. I have no idea.
Yeah, they are existing customer for sure. Yep.
Yeah. Now, the question is, what broke first? And when you put the system into live production, and I think it's been around for 12 months, am I correct?
Yeah, over a year now.
Correct. It's over a year now. What was the first assumption that died on contact with reality?
That's a great question. I'll do my best answering this. And I'd, you know, if I could phone a friend, I'd probably bring it over to our data science team and stuff like that. I think it's like, as you can imagine, right? And this is more of it's a general response, but it's really applicable, right? When you're deploying, you know, LLMs within, you know, a standard workflow or services, there's always this perception of what the content that it's producing, the output, the performance, is it accurate or not? Because it always sounds really, really good. So I think for me, what I would say as an observation is, you know, early days assumptions and the early customers that we worked with are truly partners. And a lot of it was trial and error and experimentation and validation, benchmarking, et cetera. But like, I would say the most difficult thing, and I wouldn't say it broke, but it was being able to take this internal technology that I mentioned that we made and making it accessible to the market. The biggest hurdle was making it accessible to these TMS systems, internal customer, I would call it proprietary tech or homegrown tech, things of that nature. That was complicated, right? Because essentially you have to structure the piping, you have to structure these insights. But the way that Opal works today is we have this quality estimation component. So how do I feed these insights back into these external ecosystems? But when it comes to PE specifically, it really goes into like how accurate is, you know, well, the accuracy is always good. I'll call it that way. But what you see though is that LLMs, they're quite good at grammar and accuracy, as we all know. But when it comes into like brand drift and some of the things that are really relevant to terminology, that's where you really need to ensure that those linguists are in the loop to ensure that we don't have anything being approved. Because one of the risks with like a closed loop, you know, reinforcement system with human feedback is that as content's approved, it goes back in as reinforcement data to retrain or improve the system, right? And so one of the things there is you can imagine the early days of quality estimation. We might have seen QE locking segments that it shouldn't have, and then maybe our linguists miss that. And this is, again, first one or two customers where you're truly in MVP taking this to market. But that's what I would say is really the perspective of AI, because it looks at matching data. It doesn't have a perception like a human, but that's the thing that it introduced that I think that, I don't want to call it disruptive, but it was a really good signal to realize this is interesting. Where do we need to upskill our linguists to be hyper dedicated and specific to the tasks that they're doing? Because if the content reads fluently, doesn't mean it's accurate. And so we actually needed them to spend more time to ensure the integrity of the data coming through the system, the content flowing through the system, wasn't actually introducing risk.
Which brings me to the next topic, which the heart of the matter, I guess, and that's what made me book this episode, which the claim that better AI output made a human review more important, and not because of anything, but maybe because the errors become rarer, harder to spot, becomes a little bit more unusual from your regular post editing, where, you know, I've seen some of those. Some of this output coming out of AI. And when I worked for Lionbridge up till November, I got our linguistic team or linguist team and the director of linguistic services show me a few things in French makes my eye rolls. I bageled my coffee. You know, if you want to order a coffee with bagel, that's the French version. The English version came out. I bageled my coffee. So this is hard. It's not hard to spot, but for somebody who's reading fast, you probably missed that. So, for better AI output, the normal thinking would say, I probably have lesser PE post-editing effort. But the case here is you need to spend more time on post-editing. It's almost backward for the logical thing. I know you're on the inside and you understand it a lot better than the outside looking in, but would you mind explaining it in a sort of like clean way to people that don't know this and watching it from the outside the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So to your point, to like summarize that, there is this common consensus that like, hey, if it is reading well and is performing well, why do we need these humans anymore? But to what I just mentioned, you know, I think risk is going to be one of the number one things we hear about in our industry over the next few years. Because with AI, again, like you brought up two flows that we have. And I didn't acknowledge that, just to quickly acknowledge that as well, is yes, we have Opal with human in the loop. And yes, we have Opal with no human in the loop. Because at the end of the day, who owns risk? It's not us as the vendor. It's the customer that needs to define that risk. And so then it's for us to align the right resources to combat that risk. And so with the use of AI, imagine if you have no human in the loop. One thing to note is you don't want a linguist a quality team, AI data science team, to take any of that content and to use it as reinforcement learning, right? That's going to exist over here and maybe benefit off of all the data and the content that's captured from a linguist in the loop. So there is just two very distinct paths, if you will, of when a linguist is needed versus when it's not. And again, that's up to the customer to decide. When the linguist is involved and to the point, because the content reads so well, however, it might be completely off, we need these specialized linguists now. And I say specialized, like for our clients, imagine that they produce technology, like an actual physical hardware device. You want individuals that actually know that company, their cultural references, they understand the brand, the terminology, because they need to ensure that there's nothing that slips through that could pollute that data. And I speak in these terms because all of that creates distortion over time, drift, if you will, or, you know, generally speaking, hallucination. So in other words, that's what we found is like, as content is being edited in the future state generated, we're going to need more specialized linguists versus generalized linguists to be involved on a per customer basis, or even more specifically on those content databases, because they're going to understand the patterns of how AI is producing content. And they're going to know what they need to look out for. You know, a great example, imagine if like we have a whole legal arm of the company. Historically, imagine like, you know, with MT and TMs and things of that nature and your match rates, maybe that effort would take, you know, I'll say 30 seconds or a minute just to do a quick pass through. But now, due to the nature of that content and the risk that it poses, you need to ensure that nothing's being introduced. MT didn't introduce things. It just recycled historical content. AI has the freedom to think, and what it doesn't know and why hallucinations happens, it fills gaps because it wants to execute on that task that you have. So we really need that intentional, you know, engagement from our linguists to ensure that the content is truly aligned, it's accurate, it's compliant. There is no risk that's being introduced because, again, for them, now they're kind of this gatekeeper, this guardrail, if you will, within these content workflows, to ensure that nothing sneaks through to create issues over time.
What does this do to the rate card, do you think, Kate?
Oh, man, I didn't know we were going to get into rates today, Robin. You can't put me in the spot. It's funny because, you know, I've listened to some podcasts and there's a lot of people. Honestly, I had two customers in the past 3 months where they're like, hey, we need to adopt AI. We probably need to go to RFP. However, I'm like, great, what do you need help with? You know, I'll be your partner vendor and help drive this process forward to whatever we need to do to get you to the next evolution of your business. Yeah. They simply said, we don't know how to price this in the world of AI. Everybody has a different flavor because, you know, think about it. If you're a technology provider, how do you generate revenue in the world of AI? You have a technology fee, typical SaaS model, and then maybe a throughput. Well, then on the vendor side, you have your historical rates, maybe you have discounts, maybe you have leveraging rates, things of that nature. But then you get into the realm of like, well, wait a minute, in the world of LLMs, do we need fuzzy matches anymore? So when you start actually disassembling the historical frameworks of why TMS systems were so valuable back in the day, is that even needed? I don't have an answer. I just know it's an ongoing conversation. And so I'm just seeing these hybrid approaches of course, from the technology influencing throughput, and then you have a human layer on top of it, or you have vendors these days that are providing a service and then they're adding on an additional tax potentially for technology fee. So I think for me, I think we're going to get to this interesting intersection, and not to get too future state here because I'm not seeing this at scale. But so a question that like I would, you know, ask you or anybody in the industry is like, well, what happens when we get out of a traditional localization flow and we get into content generation? What happens when there's no longer a source and target segment?
That's exactly what people are fighting for now. Why are we transforming the content? Why don't we create it directly, intentionally, in its target language? Like, why are we transforming it? We're creating it in English and we're converting it to another language. I think, and I don't know, some companies have started already. I know four or five companies, I've hosted two or three of them on my podcast, where they're doing content generation in the target language on purpose. This is not, they're selling it as a service to some of their customers. It is possible right now, and the transformation is happening because, let's face it, I had a call just before this podcast with another localization leader, but that was on the inside of a customer. She was leading like localization teams across many companies in the US. Very interesting insights. And one of them would say, look, you know, we are going to move away from, you know, I want to be sold to as an LSP, traditional selling to a customer. The other thing would be is, you know, the generic one, we want to be a partner, not a vendor. Throw that out. You know, what she's emphasizing is, look, we need to produce outcome from these translations. We don't want translation to be like the industry complained about it for many years. Translation is an afterthought. To anybody.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a revenue driver. Where's the ROI? Why are you doing it? It's like a utility service, right? Well, we need to, because we have people there.
Correct. Now, the connection between translation and outcome, nobody has put their finger on it yet. A lot of people have rudimentary data here and there, and they present a report. Sometimes it means something, sometimes it doesn't. But nobody has yet connected. If I translate your site to whatever Spanish, you are going to convert, you know, extra sales, extra visitors. How is that going to impact your business down the road? Yeah. And the regulatory stuff, everybody knows that, right? Checkbox it. You know, it's by regulation. You have to check it. You know, if you do business in Quebec, for instance, and you don't translate into French, you are going to get a visit from the OQLF. I'm sorry, you will. But the other part of it is, if you're obligated by government, by states, whoever, to translate, you have to translate. What we're talking about is the commercial side, the enterprise side, where you know, up to not too long ago, I heard companies keep telling, you know, saying, if you don't speak English, you don't need to buy a product.
Like, which is crazy.
It's just stupid, in my opinion. I mean, up to a year ago, I was talking to a manufacturer in Midwestern Canada, I think it was in Manitoba somewhere, I can't remember. I was trying to convince them, look, you, on your website, it says you're selling to almost like 100 countries. Your website is in English. Like, it doesn't make sense. You don't want to put it into the other languages? No. They understand English. I said, man, they understand maybe how to order a beer in English. They don't understand complex machineries in English.
You got it. Like, Robin, to your point, like if I could jump in here, because like I was at a localization event a little over a month ago in San Francisco, right? And it was a nice dinner. There's maybe, I think there's probably about 150 people there. And they had these breakout rooms. And one of them
But did you attend it? I was there, man.
Oh, I was there too. Were you at Global Saki?
Yeah, I did.
That's funny. So I was down there, right? And this topic right here has been this burning thing in my brain for like a couple of years now, because I'm like, if we can crack this, guys, we have a long road ahead of us and everybody in the industry is going to be happy, right? Yep. And one of the use cases I saw on the flip side, to your point around someone not having the systems in place, right? I walked into the tech breakout room and they're just talking about like the architecture and process and workflows and all these things. And I can't remember the name of the company that the lady worked for, but they just went through an acquisition. They'd bought a technology company and their software, and they had translated into a couple languages. And she said the German translations were so bad that all of those users were defaulting back to English, which was just blowing my mind. And I'm like, there's a correlation there on revenue, obviously, the stickiness. So I'd simply ask them, like, are you guys doing heat mapping on your product? And she's like, no, I don't think so. And so it's like, well, man, if you had that data on every locale for a product, you could then track your user engagement, your user sessions. That would give you direct correlation with how good the quality of your content is, because if someone's using something and the next thing they do is go and change the language setting, that's a direct correlation to value. One thing I'll share, I can't say the name of the company, but it's okay. It's perfect. It's just like perfect timing. I actually had one customer, and this was yesterday, tell me that they'd done an internal ROI analysis and they have a direct correlation on their localization spend. Okay. I won't say the specifics, but I'll give some context. They let me know for every dollar spent for one locale, they were seeing hundreds and hundreds of dollars return, which was fascinating. For their worst performing, it was every $1 spent on localization, they were seeing tens of dollars return. And they're in the technology space, they're building products. But for me, that was the music to my ears, because I'm like, now we have this justification of what we need to build and why, because we can show the impact of quality localized product and content going to market. And that, from an economic standpoint, I think is really what's going to distinguish the shift for our industry in the future. Once we can kind of come together and have frameworks in place to work with these clients or to work with a new startup on why they need to do something, but to show them that the, you know, X potential revenue that can be had, I think that's going to be really disruptive for us, because right now that's my biggest frustration. It's like, it's not a utility service, guys. This isn't just something that needs to exist because you have people around the world. This is you connecting with people. This is you driving, you know, consumer conversion when it comes to them buying your product, but most importantly, the stickiness of them using your technology.
I'm not worried about saying this, but I will say it because I interviewed somebody on it. In Pakistan, for instance, you've got an entire mobile user community using the mobiles in English. And although it is translated to Urdu and Pashto, et cetera, the local languages, but they default to English. Why?
The translations are that bad?
That bad, 100%.
Isn't that fascinating, right?
And I interviewed, it's on my podcast, look it up. I interviewed one of the linguists in the area. I said, why is it bad? He said, I made the case repeatedly to Google and the Power to Be.
Yeah.
Change the glossary. The glossary is wrong. You're using the wrong terminology. Nobody answered him. That's his claim. I don't know, but that's his claim.
And it's still a strategic insight, though, right? Because that shows you the impact of just like having intention to bridge whatever it is you're offering to that market. It's really addressable, and it's not that expensive if you already are going through the translation process. Just do some research up front and come together and build a term base. You know what I mean?
No, but to your point, if you are going to do bad translation, people are not going to use it.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So it's like in that case, it's almost better, right? Just to stay in English to your earlier example and just have a perspective, because if you're going to go run the marathon, at least run through the tape. You know what I mean? Like if you're going to translate something, why not at least just translate it well?
Yeah. Now, one of the next topic I want to chat with you, if you don't mind, this is based on Melissa's email when she reached out to me.
Yeah.
And was around the topic that AI does not reduce the need for human expertise. It more concentrates it. It puts it into more skilled workforce. Now, I don't know how much you know about me, about my history. I ran Lionbridge Canada for a long time, and I've spent 26 years doing this. So if you consider the entire industry as a pyramid where you got junior translators at the bottom and the highly skilled one, they rise to the top of that pyramid. If we are taking away the base of that pyramid because to automation, et cetera, where do we get the next senior translator? Because junior becomes senior down the road.
Absolutely.
What's your thinking there?
You know, and this isn't like representative of like the company's thinking necessarily, meaning like this is like a philosophical view. And I think about this all the time because it is true. There's going to be this convergence point. And we see this generally in AI, right? Entry-level jobs are potentially going away. Because now those, you know, lower barrier to entry tasks can be automated via agentic systems, where I think that is going to be a problem, right? I think, you know, for instance, one of my colleagues, he was a professor at a very large university here in the States, and he was a professor going over and, you know, educating folks on translation localization to help them like bridge the gap to enter the industry. And I asked him, I'm like, hey, why did you step out of teaching? He's a fantastic educator. He's a brilliant dude. And he simply said exactly what you just mentioned. He's like, I can't feel good giving people this guidance and this pathway into a position that might not be historically how we've perceived it in the past. I don't know if they can get that entry-level job anymore. So I'll talk about the top-down really quick. And I used this example earlier. I think from a language perspective, again, like the need for generalist local linguists, if you will, it is going away. And it's because the need for the specialized resources based on the content type or the very specific products or, you know, creative that might be involved. It's like they're becoming more of an extension of the customer. And, you know, of course, we're LSPs and we've always wanted to be that for a customer, but it truly is they need to become specialists. And the importance of that is, one, again, understanding the content to ensure that they're able to more or less address any potential issues or risks that's introduced. But most importantly, they're actually doing like a data labeling exercise. It's no different than why, say, a frontier lab goes and works with a company that provides an annotation service or content generation or prompt and response generation. And in that regard, it was generalized, you know, content gathering. But now they're looking for PhDs, they're looking for researchers, they're looking for whatever specialists, right, that industry might need. And that's because the information flowing back to do the reinforcement learning or to train these models, or in our case, to give us really high quality referenceable materials to leverage within our agentic systems, you have to have that type of resource within that role. So for me, that's one thing, now bringing it back into the company's perspective, that we're constantly looking at is like, how can we create this framework where you almost like, I don't know, I look at it, it's like, imagine, you know, someone graduates high school, or, you know, some countries while you're in high school, you go down a specialized route. Or I think it's going to be more aligned with like, hey, what is your background outside of linguistics? What can you perform well in? What can you be upskilled to perform well in? And I think we're truly going to see, you know, these professional aspects in this industry really shape into, you're a linguist for this dedicated industry or for this dedicated customer, because that's the only way to guarantee, I guess you could say, quality as well as the risk reduction at scale.
Now, this goes into that whole value, you know, definition. What is our value? And it goes down to the individual value. If you're a junior translator and you're a generalist, time to move on from that, maybe get specialized, maybe focus on a specific track of what you want to do and get deeper in it. We always say, you know, instead of being 1 inch thick, 2 mile wide, just get a little deeper into a specific topic, get a little bit more specialized, create value within that environment. If you are a medical interpreter or a medical translator, you know, strengthen that, get a little bit more training, get a little bit more precision on it. That creates a lot of value. But if you're, you know, doing regular HR or a regular general translation, unfortunately, that's got to go away. It's easy to replace that with technology. Now, my favorite topic, and I just couldn't believe I heard that, the walled garden. I love that. I think that's your invention, I think. I don't know. But I'm
hopefully
just
I don't get canceled during this segment here, Robin. But yeah, the walled garden.
You just embedded, I think, and I got that from my digging into it, Opal natively inside phrase. Did I get that right?
You're correct. Yep. We partner with them right at the beginning of the year as a technology partner, which then allows any of their customers to leverage our Opal tech via their TMS without them having to be our CMS, or excuse me, our CMS, our LSP customer, our translation customer.
Now, obviously everybody knows phrase, a platform, many would call, it's someone else's territory almost, a platform like phrase, it's somebody else's
absolutely
business, obviously, that's not, unless you're phrase, you're actually buying the service from them. This is deliberate bet on open ecosystems. Mm-hmm. What makes it?
So what makes it an open ecosystem for us to partner with them?
What's the logic?
Yeah, exactly. So it was really pinpoint down to like an early adopter of Opal, one of our customers, right? Really, you know, Fortune 100 company producing content at scale. We have a segment of their work, right? And we've worked with them, I think, for over 15 years. And so we had implemented Opal, and again, they're seeing cost reduction. The quality is guaranteed. That's our value prop, if you will. Hey, regardless of the tech that you use, our guarantee is that you're not going to diminish quality. They said, hey, we'd love to now introduce this into, say, the greater company or to allow our other vendors to use it. Naturally, all of these LSPs or vendors in the space, we have our own internal technology, our own, you know, what do you want to say, like project management, facilitation, billing, all of these things. So it's not like an easy shift just to do an extension of that and bring say, a potential competitor within your own roof and into your ecosystem. So we reached out to Phrase, and we established our technology partnership with the intention, right, of allowing any of these customers, say that are a Phrase customer, to leverage what we believe to be some of the technology in the space, where they can leverage that across any of the vendor ecosystem or landscape that they'd like to. So for us, we wanted to invert it versus like, hey, let's keep this enclosed. You can only have access to it if you're our vendor. You know, only if we give you our services can you use our tech. And we're like, no, like, we're really proud. I'm really proud of, like, you know, we have a really brilliant team with Aaron, Darren, and Chris leading our technology organization, that we're just quite confident. It's like, no, let's make it available. Of course, we'll be involved just to get it set up. We'll do the data science required. We'll do the quality checks, all of that to ensure that truly it's the most performative configuration. But shoot, if you want to go work with five other LSPs and you're not leveraging us, that's okay too. So for us, that was our methodology of partnering with them. And then in addition to that, they call it a partnership, but really it's more of like a technology partner where we registered with Blackbird. We really like what, say, Bruno and that team's doing over there, where what they've done is they've taken all of these components of the industry and all the content sources, and they make it accessible. And so for us, we also made Opal accessible within that ecosystem. And then we also have, say, I guess you could say in-house connectors into other TMS platforms as well. Again, with the intention of like, hey, whatever ecosystem you want to move into, not a problem. We've also partnered with some large language models. So our technology will be available via their ecosystems in the near future. I don't think that that's been approved this week, so I don't want to be too premature when I announce that. But the goal is there too. So we talked about this human, no human in the loop. Now imagine when someone goes into their LLM on their computer and they're working and they have a Word document and they just need a quick translation, making it that accessible. So again, for us, it's walled garden, one for the competitive landscape, but also then for the customer, where they're not tied into having to use, you know, anything that would be a requirement. In other words, we're giving them a key to every door that we see that would give them access to our technology to be able to facilitate their localization services. I will plant this as well, Robin, just real quick. We do have some technology we're building, really excited to be taking that to market with the team that really is aligned with future state customer needs. It's complementary to everything in the space, as I mentioned. That's how Opal is. But now what we've done is we've went a little bit farther upstream to tackle some of those internal technical restrictions that customers also face. Because one thing we have to keep in mind, I have a handful of customers right today where they're like, hey, I got a tech budget. They want me to do something with AI. So I have my own LLM that can translate content into these languages. We're like, great. What about the rest? Well, it's not good at that yet. You know, we know that story, but we're also positioning ourselves as partners to understand that, like, I think over the next few years, especially within like mid-market enterprise all the way up to, you know, some of the largest companies in the world, and as the technology is more accessible and the cost is there, that we will see more experimentation. And so I should just say our philosophy is also accounting for that as well. It's like, hey, there's a today need. That's how we're countering it with Opal. But then also, how can we create these collaborative environments so the customer never, you know, experiences restriction when they're even trying to facilitate their own internal localization process that they might invent in the near future?
No, for the audience, what Kincaid is talking about, this industry has spent years trying to create a closed, locked-in stack where they can put the customer in and the customer can't escape anymore. What he was explaining right now, which is very, very pivotal and quite the departure from a strategic perspective, what he's saying right now and what should be true is if you have a closed-in stack, that's a strategic liability for you in an AI era. In an AI era where people can build their own things and they don't need, unless you make the case for them that they need you, they can go depart and do it on their own. And we've seen it, people building models using Copilot and a few other things. Not to perfection, that's fine. It does what they need to do. But having the ability to bring your own model into that walled garden that Kincaid is talking about and work with other vendors, I've known many companies that they have a stack, tech stack, that would only allow them to use it, you know, the LSP to use that stack. Nobody else is allowed to use it. In today's age, that's a huge limitation. That's a big, big limitation. Customers want freedom of choosing, wants a convenience and wants also ability to pull in and out sort of their tech stack or their components of the tech stack as they see fit. Kudos. This is good. I really like,
thanks,
I really
Robin. Like that model. I appreciate that. Yeah, we're really excited for it. It's just one little funny story. I think it emphasizes what you just said. We've had customers where, to your point, they deploy a Copilot and they're like, hey, if you just need a quick like MT related quality translation, just go put it into this LLM. And then the IT department comes back 6 months later and it's like, why do I have a bill for $500,000? You know what I mean? And so this is a thing you have to think too. So it's like, hey, if you implement our solution, it could be internal. We don't even have to be the services. Again, no human in the loop. We could at least give you some insights, some tracking, some monitoring to de-risk some of these scenarios that we're seeing. Because everybody's like, well, I've been meaning to translate this content for the past 2 years. Let me just drag and drop this entire folder. Little do they know it's hundreds of thousands of strings or whatever it may be. So I just like to call that out. It's like, it's a silly thing to state, but it's truly a risk within large businesses because the average individual doesn't understand, like, you know, the impact of going through that end-to-end process truly is, financially speaking.
And you bring up very, you know, initially during the conversation, you brought up a very important point is the customer needs to figure out which pieces of their content is at risk, medium risk, low risk, high risk, et cetera, and choose the perfect process for those types of content. Now, I've seen customers and I've been in front of customers for almost 30 years. They tell me, oh, we need all the above. We need it high quality, cheap. we need it magically to appear, the genie thing. I'm talking about those with the logical expectation. I'm not talking about the crazy ones. But the expectation here is that the customers are more familiar with their own content than an outside supplier, generally speaking. As the relationship deepens, of course, the outside supplier becomes more embedded into the customer process and they can now judge the content more logically, more systematically, succinctly, etc. But let's say you're doing a brand new RFP with a brand new customer. Coming from the outside in, you need a bit of a ramp up time to understand what that content looked like. Then you start advising logically on the type of content and the type of direction you want to send that content.
Spot on. And that's exactly why we structured Opal to work the way that it does today. To your point, any of the customers we've had for years, we're an extension of them. We understand the goals, the objectives, the wants, the needs, if you will. But for any of those new customers, it's a part of the service that we offer is like, we really go in there. We understand the goals and objectives. Most importantly, if they have historical translations that we can even have as reference. To your early example on the mobile company, do they have glossaries? Do they have terminology? Things of that nature. And that becomes very critical on structuring that approach. Because again, with Opal, we can deploy it across all languages, but we can also do it on content types. So then to your point, you can also structure conditional routing based on this intention of quality. So human, no human, but everything flowing into a human, we have then the quality estimation. So we have all of these little data points that we can capture, which is so critical. And then that's the, I guess you could say, the levers that we get to adjust, say on a monthly, quarterly basis to, again, really make the most efficient pipeline for our customers possible.
This is very, very, very interesting and very timely discussion. And for those of you, for the 19,000 companies in this industry, if this conversation of interest to you, I'm assuming you can reach out to Kincaid and have a conversation.
Anytime.
With him. I'm really happy that we got a chance to connect. Now, let's, if you don't mind, as my wrap-up question, Kincaid, 3 years out, what does localization org chart look like? Which roles do you think will stop existing, disappears, and which roles do you think will get invented?
It's a really good question. Again, as you can imagine, something I think about often. I'm really curious to see what's going to happen when we get into content generation. We know that that's going to be applicable for certain content types. You know what I mean? Products, things of that nature, that's, you know, not necessarily relevant. But like in the world of marketing and things like that, I could see us really having those in-country, it's like transcreation, if you will. So having marketing or in-market representatives on behalf of a company that own that market's perception, which would then truly take over this and then pipeline, this service, this workflow, et cetera. So I think from a quality, if you will, and when it goes into like the content and the linguist, I think it's going to become more decentralized. However, I think the greater process as a whole, I think we're going to see more technology arms of, you know, businesses because they own, you know, the deployment of LLMs and these workflows becoming more aggressive in developing their own solutions. So I think there's kind of two sides of this coin, as my colleague likes to say, where you're going to see a collapse internal within these large entities, and then you're going to see a distribution of ownership within those local markets. And think of it this way. It's like, imagine like that highly skilled linguist, let's say if it's for legal content, and maybe it's a multi-country legal entity. I could see those linguists, funny enough, being promoted internally or potentially as an extension of the LSP or even as a customer to truly own markets. Because then from there, they're ensuring that all of the data that's being harnessed, all the content that's going out, once we figure out this ROI thing, it'll make their lives a little bit easier, right? I think that's how it's going to be distributed. Again, I think current state localization is truly looked at as a utility service. Generally speaking, that's not my perspective. I want to call that out. And so I think as the value is actualized and it's measured, the role in the ownership will be defined differently internally. And I don't know if it'll be called localization in the future, you know?
Yeah,
so my two cents is content gen is going to be highly disruptive. And then again, the one thing say the quiet thing out loud is at the rate that these models are progressing, we don't know what this is going to look like in the next 2 to 3 years.
Every conversation we're having, Kincaid, has got a short expiry date to it.
So I'm time stamping that for the sake of the podcast that, I don't know, let's see what happens with the next Anthropic update. I'm joking, of course, but the reality is the linguist will always be needed. The infrastructure in order to facilitate content at scale will always be needed. So I know there's a place for companies such as ours in the market. It's just around ownership and the measurement of value, I think, is what's going to distinguish who owns what piece of this journey in this workflow.
Thank you, Kincaid. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Robin. Really appreciate the time today.
Kincaid, this is really, for me, it's exactly the kind of conversation I wanted to be honest with you. A year ago, when I started this show, I started arguing human in the loop is non-negotiable. You need to have a human in the loop. Today, I think you told us that, you know, here's the production data and here's what's behind that theory, which I really sort of backed up the theory with evidence and details around that. So I appreciate you bringing that topic to the audience of the Localization Fireside Chat. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Robin. Really appreciate the conversation today and looking forward to our next conversation in the future.
Absolutely. Consider this podcast your podium. Anytime you have an update, please come back and we'd love to host you.
Thank you so much.
For the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me in on this conversation with Kincaid Day, our VP at WeLocalize. And we want to thank you so much for your contribution to this conversation. I also want a big thank you to Kincaid and the rest of the guest speakers that they come in on the podcast, the preparation they go through, the organization, the logistics that goes in. There's a lot of work that goes behind the scene that the audience don't know about this. But I want to appreciate that. I'm grateful for that. I'm very thankful for this. Because I know how much it takes. I mean, I'm an army of one. I know how much it takes to produce one episode. But also the guests, they come in, they prepare, they want to deliver a message. And that's very important to them. And they get that right. So thank you again for watching us on YouTube. If you're watching us on YouTube, thanks so much. And if you're listening in on the podcast, okay, thank you so much for listening. I see the downloads are going up. I greatly appreciate it. And also, if you're reading our blog where I summarize these conversation in an archivable form, thanks for checking us out on the blog post, robinayoub.blog. Until next time, this is Kincaid Day and Robin Ayoub signing off. I'll see you at the next episode.